Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you are listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. This week's show is going to be off the charts. We're starting out with our dating news of the week, then moving into our Hollywood report, and then we'll be talking to three guests today. We're going to be talking to legal expert Dominic Rossetti about this interesting law in North Carolina about nipples being exposed and the potential felony charges associated with exposing one's nipple in public. Then we're going to be talking to body language expert Vanessa Van Edwards about what type of body language are you giving off when you're dating. Then we'll be talking to PhD candidate and relationship therapist Jason Harley about what happens when two people come together in a couple but have differing political views. All right, let's get this party started. In dating news this week, where are all the single ladies? I know that most sites are designed by men and don't really cater to a female clientele, but there's this new app out there called Swoon, which is designed by women and supposedly for women. It's a site that has a more educated and older demographic. Approximately 50% of their users are women, and the average age of the user is 27. So they're trying to avoid this hookup culture that we see on many dating sites like Tinder and Pure App, which I've talked about on the show before. But there's another interesting thing about Swoon that I really want to get into. This app allows women to send the picture and profile of the individual that they're interested in to a friend via text. I can't begin to tell you how many profiles I've looked at of guys my friends or clients have been interested in. You know, some of them will be like, oh my gosh, I'm so worried. His chin's too big. What do? I can't marry this guy if my kid's going to have his chin. Obviously, it's time to then pull them back, rein them in, and bring them back to reality. But you could do this theoretically by using the Swoon app. So I'm interested in seeing whether or not this takes off and if I get some messages from friends who are using Swoon with some prospective partners in the near future. Okay, so it's the OK Corral when it comes to dating. There seems to be no regulation of the industry. There have been a lot of issues in the past with this, specifically photos being taken of individuals who don't necessarily belong to the site. There's new regulatory commission, however, in Britain that's designed to combat this. Britain has developed this commission, which they're calling the Online Dating Association, and it's made up of several major online dating sites, including eHarmony and Match, and they're going to be providing guidelines that online dating sites have to abide by, and also giving tips to consumers to help them navigate online dating sites and provide them with information regarding protecting themselves, their identity, their data, and their safety when dating online. I think this is a really great idea, and I wonder if something like this will develop in the US. It remains to be seen. Okay, dads with smaller nads. Yes, I said it. Dads with smaller nads, as in gonads. So there are these professors at Emory University, which all of you know is my alma mater. I'm very proud. And they were just publishing this study in the Penis Journal. No, I said it. It's PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And no, I'm not a 12-year-old boy, but I thought it was very funny that a study about gonads was being published in a journal called PNAS. So this study tries to understand whether or not men who have smaller gonads are more likely to allocate their time differently and have a more adaptive and involved parenting style. And they find, in fact, that men with smaller testicles are better parents in that they spend more time doing daily activities with their children, such as changing their diapers, giving them baths, feeding them, etc. Basic caretaking things that most people associate today with mothers. They started out this study because they were really interested in looking at how chimps and gorillas, and chimps are obviously my favorite animal, everybody knows this, have smaller testicles than other mammals. And the chimps and the gorillas also seem to be better caregivers as fathers. So they were interested in this because of the chimps and decided to look into it a bit further. So they look at 70 couples and they ask the wife about the involvement of her husband in these daily tasks of child rearing. They monitor their testosterone levels, do MRIs, etc., and they're trying to explore, you know, what constitutes being a good parent. And according to the study, they're finding that men who have smaller gonads are also changing more diapers, doing all of these things that we have considered traditional parenting behavior. What's happening? There isn't this perfect association between behavior necessarily and having smaller testicles. And they're also wondering whether or not being a better parent may cause this shrinkage. Yes, I've just referenced Seinfeld. He was talking about a different kind of shrinkage, though. Maybe it's time to bust some balls if we want to have good parenting. All right, America's most eligible bachelor. All right, Shelley Zimmerman stood by her man the entire trial of her husband, George Zimmerman, in the Trayvon Martin case. And now they've filed for divorce, or at least she has. But this is now heating up, ladies and gentlemen. It seems that, recently, Shelley Zimmerman has accused her husband of slapping her father as she was trying to move out of their house and while they were separating. This occurred a couple days following the filing for divorce. But in America, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in the court system, but in the court of Dr. Jess, we think that he's actually guilty. So, ladies, he's up for grabs. Who wants George Zimmerman? All right, that's our dating news of the week. Be right back, lovers and friends, with the Hollywood Report. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had our dating news of the week, and now we're going to get into our Hollywood Report. The theme of the Hollywood Report seems to be All in the Family. Apparently, the show Mrs. Eastwood and Company wasn't all that successful, so Clint and Dina decided to call it quits after 17 years of marriage. Now, Dina and Clint are dating a couple that has split. It's kind of like Bob Carroll, Ted and Alice, the movie from the 1960s. Really funny movie about couples sort of swapping their spouses, except those couples in the movie were married, whereas now these couples are both split. So Clint Eastwood, who's 83, is now dating the wife of the person that Dean Eastwood, his wife, is now dating. Kind of confusing, but kind of creepy all at the same time. Let's put it this way. These celebrities are keeping it all in the family. Okay, J-Date, Christian Mingle, LDS singles, Catholic singles, all dating sites catering to a religious demographic. But there's this new form of online dating, or maybe just say matchmaking within a religious community, that I didn't really know about until the other day. Apparently, Scientologists are also developing their own matchmaking system. Well, maybe not generally, but at least for Tom Cruise, their golden boy. And Tom Cruise has a lot of criteria that he set for his next wife, number four. So she has to be a member of the church for at least 5 years. She should be between her mid to late 30s. And she should also have been involved in Hollywood. Let's see how well that has worked out for him in the past. He's been married to Mimi Rogers, Nicole Kidman, and Katie Holmes. Clearly, maybe he needs to look outside of the Hollywood community. However, he's now dating Jessica White. So I'm sort of confused. Is he still interested in dating other women? Whose couch is he going to be jumping up on and down next? Okay, that's the Hollywood Report, lovers and friends. I'm going to play some music and be right back with Dominic. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. I'm glad to welcome back legal expert Dominic Rossetti to talk about this new law in North Carolina about nipple exposure and the potential legal ramifications. Welcome, Dominic.
Hey, Jess, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, I'm good.
So, Dominic, you and I have been talking a lot about this law that I recently read about in North Carolina, where women can be charged with a felony if they expose their breasts for the purposes of arousal. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting law. I mean, there's a lot of free speech backdrop, First Amendment backdrop to this. Basically, the law prevents women from exposing parts of their body, typically their nipple or their areola, for the purposes of arousal. So just prohibiting a particular type of conduct, but there's also this this tension that you've got going there between this conduct and expressive conduct in the First Amendment.
Yes, so the expressive conduct, at least in this context of exposing a nipple, would be exotic dancing, trying to promote some type of art, public expression in that form, correct?
Could be. There's all sorts of different grades of speech, the way that the Supreme Court sort of divided things up over the years. You've got sort of core political speech, which would sort of fall outside of the scope of this sort of behavior. But there's also art. There's all kinds of nudity in art. Different types of art are given different levels of protection, really. So fine art, sculpture, and painting are usually protected a little more than expressive conduct. So there's lots of sort of fringe areas around the edges here that we could see that you could sort of get in trouble, right? The purpose of this law is to protect children, to protect sensitive eyes, whether they be, you know, morality-based sensitivities or younger people and children. But that's really where you're going to run into trouble here is whether or not this activity is considered expressive or whether or not it's just sort of lewd, which we can prohibit sort of lewd conduct.
We can prohibit nude conduct. Lewd conduct.
Lewd conduct. So there's all sorts of things that we don't allow people to do in public. You can't go into a park and have sex, right? That's not allowed. That's just conduct that we wouldn't call it expressive in any particular sort of way. But dancing, whether it's closed or unclosed, we do consider expressive, and that is an art form, and we sort of consider it in a different way. The states and the federal government are allowed to prohibit specific conduct, so you can't run around and, you know, you can't run your car into a building. That's conduct.
Yes.
There's no expressive activity there, and there's a distinction there between something that has artistic value or scientific value, political value. Artistic value here is really the issue. Does
absolutely.
That make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So it really comes down to, how do we define the act that's occurring? Is it expressive and artistic? So my question would be, Dominic, has the Supreme Court held before that exotic dancers are afforded protection under the First Amendment for expressive conduct?
The Supreme Court has held that a variety of non-verbal speech can be protected.
Okay.
This can be sexual. This could be flag burning in the case of Texas v. Johnson.
Yes.
That's not literal verbal, you know, words, but it's definitely conduct that means something to particular people. In that case, it's more political than artistic, but there's certainly a range of speech that can be covered by the First Amendment that's not speech per se.
Got it. So if a woman in North Carolina decides to expose her nipples while dancing in a strip club, would that be considered illegal?
See, that's where we kind of get fuzzy. There's a lot of cases that hold different things in a lot of different places, and depending on where you are, the value of sort of morality in the court can slide a little bit. In places like Las Vegas, that's perfectly legal. Women can be totally nude dancing, and there can be alcohol everywhere in Vegas, and nobody seems to mind. In North Carolina, this could be totally different. And in respect to the Constitution, there's sort of a gray area. We don't really know what the court would hold. We know that the courts held that there is a value to morality. Like I said, there is a value for these sensitive eyes, and the government does have a little power to regulate as far as expressive speech is concerned, so it's really unclear.
Okay, so somebody's basically going to have to take off their shirt and in a strip club and have some type of court case in front of the courts to try to determine whether or not what North Carolina is doing is infringing on expressive speech. Is pretty much what's going to happen.
I think that's right. Yeah, the court tends to do funny things when sex is involved.
Yes, they do.
So we have to see it wind all the way up, and a particular question would have to fall in front of 9 particular justices, and we'd have to hear their answer to that specific question.
Well, you know what, Dominic, you mentioned something that's interesting to me, this idea of topless strip clubs, because I think our listeners would be very curious to know that there are lots of different forms of stripping. Like, there's topless strip clubs, and then there are fully nude strip clubs. And then, based upon the type of nudity that's being experienced, you have restrictions on your behavior, such as alcohol use, which you also mentioned. I find this to be fascinating.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely, I agree. It's totally fascinating. You can go to Vegas and have a vodka soda and watch a girl dance totally naked, and that is just not possible in California. In California, you can have any kind of liquor where the girls are in a bikini where they're fully covered, And then there's the sort of middle ground where the girls are topless and you can have beer and wine. And then there's the fully nude where you can't get anything to drink at all. So it's just this strange range that we've created for ourselves with the legislators to sort of protect ourselves and protect the dancers and protect the community. Very, very interesting, though. I don't really know how much logic is behind the whole thing.
Well, especially because I think that you and I have talked about this before. I think a lot of people don't show up to strip clubs sober. So the idea that you're preventing something dangerous or immoral from happening by preventing people from drinking upon arriving at the strip club may be completely moot, given that people are completely loaded before they even get there.
Yeah, it just defies logic. Everybody that shows up to a strip club at 4 a.m. is clearly not sober, so whatever they were trying to protect against, don't know if it's really working at that point.
Absolutely. Dominic, getting back to this issue of the nipple exposure, what I found to be really interesting is that one of the state legislators in North Carolina suggested that women put duct tape over their nipples to avoid getting a felony. So, I mean, it's just really fascinating the lengths that people are going to go to or suggest that women do to prevent them from expressing their sexuality. I don't necessarily believe that a woman showing her nipple is expressive of sexuality. I think that women can express their sexuality and their own identities in multiple ways. But the idea that the nipple is so tied to women's expression of sexuality is just very interesting to me.
Well, I mean, it's not something new in America. If you go to, places in Europe and you see shampoo commercials where women are naked, and it's just sort of accepted. Usual magazines you see on the shelves have topless women in them all the time. There's topless beaches all over the world. There is a taboo definitely associated in America with the nipple, and it's definitely translated into the law as well. You can't watch regular TV and see a nipple in America, but if you wait till about 10 a.m., 10 p.m., you might be able to catch one somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the first television shows, which my mother equates to soft porn, that showed nipples was Nip Tuck, about the plastic surgeons on FX. And you saw everything on that show. And now people are watching shows like Game of Thrones, and they're continuously seeing all of this.
Yeah, it's just like a topless marathon on Game of Thrones. Everybody's mostly naked all the time.
Could North Carolina prohibit that individuals in that state can't watch or subscribe to FX later than a certain time in the evening, or does the federal law and the FCC override that? How would that work?
The TV stuff, you're getting into different territory now. We're talking about sort of, with this particular law we're talking about in North Carolina, that's sort of public conduct.
Got it.
So it does raise interesting questions as to whether or not if somebody was voluntarily entering the strip club at night, whether or not the stripper could be prosecuted for showing her nipple in that case. But the TV stuff is sort of out of bounds. Those are sort of private activities, you know?
Got it. So that makes it very clear to our listeners that it's solely public conduct that's being regulated here.
Yeah.
I'm very curious, though, about whether or not strippers will start wearing pasties, because I can't imagine somebody who goes into a strip club calling the police and saying, "I'm in a strip club and a woman is exposing her nipples. Please come and arrest her."
That probably wouldn't happen, but there's vice squads all over the country that do nothing but, gambling, prostitution, sex crimes.
Yes.
And that's their job. So
yes.
They'll send them in there and they'll do it themselves.
You know, we haven't moved past the 1920s, clearly, if there are still vice squads in action.
No. A nation of pilgrims.
Okay. Well, Dominic, just one more question to all of our mothers who are listening. A lot of women breastfeed publicly. Should women who are breastfeeding be concerned that they're going to be thrown in jail with their two children in tow for feeding their kids in public?
Probably not. Quite literally, the law could be applied to things like parades or even breastfeeding if a blanket fell down or something, or some accidental exposure occurred. Some ornery officer, I'm sure, could drag you in, but it would be quite an oddity if that went all the way through to a prosecutor's office and they really did prosecute for that. That's not to say that it won't happen. It just seems practically unlikely.
Yeah, no.
I would try and see things in the most practical light. But that doesn't mean the ACLU won't have someone go parading through the streets of North Carolina half naked just to get a lawsuit going.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm surprised that they haven't already.
Yeah, probably will.
But what's interesting, if we think about the laws in North Carolina relative to other states, so for example, you and I have talked about that I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, and I've seen men walk around completely and totally stark naked and sit and be served in restaurants. And while arguably I don't mind nudity, it's okay, it's natural, but at the same time, it's sort of offensive that the guy just sat down on the same chair as me completely and totally stark naked.
Yeah, there's nothing in the Constitution particularly against nudity, so, I mean, San Francisco has its leeway to do what it pleases, so long as nobody, you know, throws their arms up and gets angry, they can do what they want. And, I mean, there's definitely wide variation among laws between places like Seattle and Alabama or San Francisco and North Carolina. It's just a world of difference.
Sure.
Not to mention the way the laws are enforced or not enforced in different places.
Absolutely. Well, Dominic, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you, good sir.
Thank you so much, Deb.
All right, lovers and friends, I'm going to play a little bit of music and then get back with our body language expert and behavioral investigator, Vanessa Van Edwards. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. I'm really excited to have Vanessa Van Edwards, who is a Huffington Post columnist, a body language expert, a behavioral investigator, and the founder of the Science of People, with us today to talk about body language and dating. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So, Vanessa, I really think a lot about when people are going on dates, they often focus on what people say rather than what they do or how they act on a date. So I'm really curious to understand what type of body language is really appropriate to use when dating. How should you use body language to indicate interest?
Sure. So, you know, we forget that 93% of our communication is nonverbal. So only 7% is actually the words that we say. The rest is our face, our body, our voice tone, our pheromones. So remembering to focus on the body actually gives you a real added edge, especially in dating. One of the easiest ways to use body language is to show interest using body language. So one thing that we subconsciously do when we like someone is we lean towards them, mm-hmm. or we enter into their physical space, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of research has shown that there's a social zone and an intimate zone. So if you're at a bar, you're mm-hmm. on a date, and you want to gauge whether or not the person's into you and show that you're interested in them, when you grab your drink or you can lean forward and touch their elbow, cross into their intimate zone and see their reaction. Do they lean back? Do they grimace? Do they smile and lean towards you? That's a really easy, very non-threatening way to show interest and to also gauge if they're interested back.
That's a great tip. And it seems to be pretty gender neutral.
Yep, exactly. So if you're a female and you want to reach out and touch the man's elbow or hand, that's a really easy way to see if he pulls his hand back or if he leans back towards you. If you're a man, you can reach out and touch a woman's lower back. That's a typically neutral area for a woman. You'll know right away whether mm-hmm. or not she likes it or not.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I think that when you're dating somebody or trying to figure out whether or not a person's interested in dating you, I think the lower back is certainly an area that promotes intimacy because it's right in between multiple erogenous zones. So, absolutely.
And it's an easy way to show interest, but also gauge it in a non-threatening way. You know, a lot of people say, I don't know if I should go in for the kiss. I don't know if I should ask for a number or ask for a second date. That's a very easy way to know before you ask if you're more likely or not to get a yes or no.
Got it. That's a great tip. But I know that you've talked about before that men and women may use body language differently. How does that work?
Yeah, so first, men and women read body language differently as well as using it differently. So men typically use 4 to 6 areas of their brain when they're reading body language, whereas women use 14 to 17 areas.
We're multitasking.
So, yeah, exactly. Women are thinking about not only the body language, the emotions, what should I say, what should I not say. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the way that we read it is very different. Mm-hmm. And because of this, men typically miss the first 3 nonverbal courtship signals that a woman sends. So a woman typically picks up on them right away. a man misses them. So what does this tell us?
Yes.
First, women need to send 3 to 5 signals. The first one is most likely going to be missed. So you cannot be shy if you're interested in someone. You've got to show those nonverbal signals more than you think, because they're not as receptive. Their brains don't pick up as much of it as women do. And for men, to be really tuned in to what nonverbal is of someone you're interested in, so that you don't miss those signals the first few times.
Sure. So, Vanessa, what are those signals then? I mean, you use the one example of brushing one's elbow against the person or touching their lower back. What are some other non-verbal signals that people could give off?
Sure. So women, this is all from an evolutionary standpoint, right? This is what we do subconsciously when we're trying to attract someone.
Okay.
A lot of the time we don't even realize we're doing it, which actually makes it more helpful, right? We know that it's natural. So
mm-hmm.
One thing that women do subconsciously is they want to release the female pheromones that are released from their neck. Women release mm-hmm. a lot of their attraction pheromones from their neck. So what they do is they flip their hair back,
mm-hmm.
they stroke their neck, they tilt their head over to the side to release, to show, expose more of their neck, to release the pheromones into the air. So if you're a man, you're watching a woman, and she's sort of doing this preening behavior, she's tilting her neck a lot, she's laughing and touching her neck, she's stroking her necklace, those are all nonverbal courtship signals from a subconscious place.
That's great.
Men also do the same with their male pheromones, but male pheromones typically come from a lower zone, so they will often frame their crotch by putting their thumb, tucking their thumbs into their pockets.
Hmm.
That's actually a subconscious thing men do, and they also will spread their legs wide when sitting to release those pheromones.
Got it. Multiple signals being sent at one time.
Uh-huh, yeah.
No, that's really interesting, because I often see when I'm out observing people, and I can tell when people are on first dates or have been comfortable with each other for a long time, I often see the hair tuck. I call it the hair tuck, which is what you're referring to when women are stroking their hair.
Exactly, and we're programmed to do that because we know that it releases pheromones. Second, shiny, healthy hair shows fertility, so the more attention that we draw to our shiny, healthy hair, the more fertile we are. And it's also a self-touch, and self-touching reminds the man that we're talking to that he would like to touch us also.
Absolutely.
So there's a couple reasons why we do that.
That's great. So, Vanessa, I'm really curious. A lot of people use online dating. It's becoming the second most common way people are meeting a long-term partner in the United States. How do you assess body language from an online dating profile? You only have access to the pictures of a prospective partner. Can you assess body language from a profile picture?
Definitely. So there's actually a lot you can tell from someone's photo, not only about what they look like or the body language they naturally show, but also the body language that they want you to see from them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People very consciously pick their photos, and so you can also see what people want to portray. So microexpressions are a really big part of social I get tons of emails about people asking me to choose which photos they should use on dating profiles. You'd be surprised
how
often that happens. Because they want to show the correct microexpression. So, for example, there are 7 universal microexpressions. A
mm-hmm.
microexpression is a very brief, involuntary facial expression that directly correlates to someone's emotion. So you'll notice that, and I have them all for free on my website. You're welcome to go look at the guide and see if any of them are in your pictures. But one, for example, is a smirk or a one-sided mouth raise. Most people think that's an indication of happiness, but actually that's the universal microexpression for contempt.
Huh.
So you want to avoid showing a smirk in your profile, and you want to watch out for people who have smirks in their profiles, because it means there's usually a lot of sort of disdain, maybe they're a little bit more pessimistic. So that's just an example of how you can use microexpressions in your own and also reading others.
Got it. That's a really good idea. So what microexpression then should someone go for? If the smirk is the signal of don't do, what's the signal of actually do?
You definitely want to use real happiness. And what I mean by real happiness is a lot of the times if you've had either professional photos done or you tried to take some of your own pictures, people will smile, but it's not a genuine smile. And the way that you tell a genuine smile is that the muscles along the side of your eyes are activated, or the crow's feet where those wrinkles are. The only indication of a true smile or true happiness is when your smile reaches into your eyes. So I'll often see people's profile pictures are these sort of fake smiles or posed smiles, and they rub people the wrong way. So you want to try to get a picture of you actually, you know, really happy in the moment, out with friends, laughing. If you're going to have a photo shoot or you're going to take a casual shoot to get some pictures online dating, make sure that you're with someone who you're really comfortable with. Hit those things that genuinely make you happy. You have genuine happiness on your profile pictures.
That's totally a great tip. And Vanessa, I often see people post online dating profile pictures when they're at events like weddings or bar mitzvahs or some type of family event where they're actually having a great time. And I always tell people to try to find at least one of those photos where they're more dressed up but at a really happy event, but then a more natural photo where they're having fun, because you need to see both sides, the very dressed up side and the more casual side.
Yes, and that's a really great way to get the real smile. Maybe you have one of you running on the beach with your dog, and you have one at your sister's wedding when you were really happy with your family. Those two very genuine, authentic emotions within two different settings.
So, Vanessa, you said that 93% of the signals that we give off are nonverbal. But what I'm curious about is, are people very much cognizant of that? Because, I mean, I honestly didn't know that 93% of the signals I give off are nonverbal. How do people really become more attuned to the body language of another person that they might be dating?
Sure. So, yes, it's absolutely shocking that much of our communication is nonverbal. And another study found that in a 30-minute period, we send off about 800 different nonverbal cues. So everything from, you know, proxemics, which is how close you are to someone, to haptics, which is touching, to microexpressions, to voice tone, all those things. I think that it's a definite process. I wish I had a quick answer for you on that one. We have hundreds of articles on it. So I think the first step is definitely just being aware of what your body is saying. Study after study shows that we do not even know what our own body language is saying to others. So if the very first place to start is to take a fresh look at your profile pictures and think to yourself, what is my nonverbal saying here? Or on your date, be aware of, okay, how does my voice sound? What is my body saying right now? Just being aware is the first step to really changing it.
Absolutely. Well, Vanessa, these are such great tips and insights. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Lovers and friends, that was Vanessa Van Edwards talking to us about body language and dating. I'm going to play a bit of music and then get back with Jason Harley. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just talked to Vanessa Van Edwards, who is a body language expert, and now we're joined by our resident PhD candidate and therapist Jason Harley to talk about political lives and dating lives. So there was an article published recently talking about how dating has become more polarized, at least within the online community, because you're able to glean someone's political orientation through certain things they might write in their online dating profile. So, Jason, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's my pleasure. So this article that I was discussing said that individuals are more likely to sort themselves now along political lines than in the past because they now might have direct knowledge regarding somebody's political orientation, or it can at least begin to glean that from what they might write about themselves, their educational level, location, socioeconomic background. Do you think that this also happens, though, in real life? I mean, aren't people normally making educated assumptions about the people that they date?
Oh, sure. I think there's two things going on. One, we've got just a political polarization in this country as it is.
Sure.
And so people are, you know, sorting themselves just within friendships in that way, I think, at times. And then the other thing is this rise in the online dating. And so you are, as you said, you're getting much more information about people online. But in real life, when you meet people, yeah, you talk to them and you find out what their views are and you find out where they're at in life. And that's how you make your decisions, I think, if you're going to carry on with a relationship.
Absolutely. And I mean, the type of information, unless the person states what their political orientation is basically, you know, what their religion might be, what their race is. Like, those types of factors that people are essentially using to make a snap judgment about somebody's political orientation. And those snap judgments might not necessarily be true, which is also funny and sort of interesting at the same time. that people
well, yeah,
can be wrong.
Funny, 'cause when I was a younger man in my single days, I did, and this is, I'm being very stereotypical at this moment, but I did go out with a young black woman, and I really thought she was really nice and smart, and we were going out talking, and it turns out she was a Republican.
Yeah, go figure.
And I said, yeah, that was it, one date.
That was in one day. So that led to the demise of your relationship, her political orientation?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay, got it. So we know that Jason's obviously a Democrat. I'm a registered independent, everyone. But we think about, though, couples who have differing political views but make it work. I mean, look at Mary Matlin and James Carville. They seem to be doing okay. How do you think that these type of diverging political views, especially people with such strong, prominent national presences, can have a relationship that functions? Can these diverging views come together? And if so, how does it affect the relationship?
I think you see a couple things. And when you're looking at a high-profile relationship like that, I think you're seeing there is the opposites attract. I mean, there's a reason why those are sayings that are around.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain level of excitement and of that debating that primes people and gets them excited about being in the relationship because they're debating some sort of issue on an intellectual level, and that could be their particular views. And then also, I think, if you look at these particular people, or a lot of people, you know, when you're looking at the differences between conservative and liberals on economic views, they may have differences and have legitimate rationale for their differences in their views, but their social views may be very similar.
Sure.
You know, I never hear anything about, from either Mary or James, about gay marriage or, you know, things along that line.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's my understanding that both of them are Roman Catholic. But I would assume that those social values might be the ties that bind them together.
Yes.
Go ahead, Jason.
Oh, I was going to say, and then the political discourse between them is the spark that excites their relationship.
Oh, yeah. You know, nothing like a good debate on, you know, the deficit to turn you on.
You know, my parents were on a cruise, and they actually were speaking, the two of them, on the cruise, so they said they were an interesting couple. Quite funny.
Yes, no, I've seen them speak together as well, and they are definitely a dynamic duo to be reckoned with for no doubt. But given that political orientation also is transmitted from parents to children, how might this affect how parents talk to their kids about politics at the dinner table? It seems like there could be a heated debate when they're trying to teach their kids what they believe.
Right, and I think the main thing in that situation is to make sure that you're teaching your children that public debate, political debate, intellectual debate is good, it's healthy, it's stimulating. But that doesn't mean that it's negative or demeaning to another person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's going to be times when you and your spouse disagree on some particular topic, whatever it is, and you have a discussion about it, but you still love each other at the end of the day and everything's fine. You just disagree on a particular point. I think if kids see that around the table, then they're at least more willing to be open to different viewpoints. The problem that we're seeing right now is that people don't seem to be open to different viewpoints. People surround themselves with people who only agree with them, and so they tend not to look to other viewpoints.
That makes a lot of sense. Well,
I try to make sense when I can.
I appreciate that, Jason, especially on the air. So, do you think that political difference is, though, within couples, might signal larger differences, though, in values? We talk about the social values and the more economic values, but theoretically, somebody's political orientation is indicative of a worldview.
You would think. It's interesting. I remember when I was in college, they had a big group out here, Republicans for Choice.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that's kind of odd. Isn't that like Jews for Jesus? I mean, how does that work together?
Uh-huh.
And their response was, well, you know, I have conservative economic views, but I have different social views.
Sure.
So I have a friend, I have a couple, a friend who's been married, and one's very Democrat, one's very Republican. But on social issues, they do tend to agree on things. Gay marriage is a popular example right now. They do agree on that. So I think you may have some different views about economics. You know, the thing about economic views is that we don't really know what the answer is because we never seem to, one way or other, whichever way we go, it never seems to fix it.
That's quite true. But what's interesting is that this idea of maybe there are one or two issues that couples have to agree on in order to make the relationship work. For example, I have a friend who is a staunch Democrat, and her husband is from the South and a Republican. But he is definitely pro-choice, and that's an issue that she definitely would not probably have married him if he were not. That's one of her major issues that she feels very strongly about. So it's interesting to think about what are those things that are most important to us politically, and what does our partner have to align with us on that issue or those issues?
Yeah, exactly. And then what are you willing to accept? So if your friend was willing to accept that her spouse was not going to be pro-choice, but if she needed to make that decision for herself, that she could make whatever decision she wanted, that may have been okay. We don't know.
No, we don't. They're married now, so we will never know the counterfactual to that argument. But that's really interesting. I guess what I'm thinking about more so is maybe political views signal larger other views that also might be aligned, and therefore people have to agree on a variety of other issues as well. Maybe it's not just politics. Maybe people also need to agree on how to raise their children, how to interact with families generally.
Of course, you're going to have, you know, when you're dealing with a relationship and a marriage and a family that's going to go on for a long time, you know, once you get past the, oh, it's very exciting to meet you, there's going to be, who am I going to spend my time with?
Yeah.
And so there needs to be some level of at least, maybe not agreement, but acceptance of views that you think about. You know, for example, I was, again, in my younger days, I was dating a woman I really liked. She was very, very religious and thought that homosexuality was a sin. And I had friends that were homosexual, and I thought, how can I be with someone who thinks that my friends are wrong or sinning in that way? And that was a dissonance for me. I couldn't figure out how I could reconcile that.
Got it.
Is that a good example?
Well, Jason, this has been so interesting, and I look forward to having you back on the show. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you.
All right, lovers and friends, that was Jason Harley, our relationship expert and therapist, talking with us about diverging political views within couples. I'm going to play a bit of music, and then we're going to end with my dating advice for the week. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just talked to relationship expert and therapist Jason Harley, and now we're going to get into my dating advice for the week. All right, this week's advice goes into what are the top red flags that we see on a first date. Number one, scheduling. It's 30 minutes before your date, and your hair is done, you're wearing all of your makeup, everything's ready to go, you're about to head to the car. Suddenly, you get a text message. No, this is not your mother telling you to have a good time, but it's rather your date saying, sorry, rain check. 30 minutes is not an acceptable period of time for rescheduling. You must have a 24-hour period to notify the person. Obviously, emergencies always happen, but if somebody's going to be as disrespectful about your time, you know that they're probably not going to be respectful about your time later on in the relationship. Roaming. We're human. Our eyes wander. But if you're on a date and you notice that your date's eyes start looking at your waitress, other patrons, that's a bad sign. They should have their eyes on you at all times, and their eyes should be making contact with yours. Reciprocity. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all? Have you ever been on a date where you felt like the other person could have just been by themselves? I know I have. Your date should be interested in your ambitions, your past, your future. You want to find out whether or not they're really interested in you. Call of nature. Well, I know that many people have to use the bathroom at times. I know I'm one of them. The person should not be asking you when they drop you off to come inside your house to use your bathroom. That's a really, really bad sign that the individual is only interested in trying to get one thing pretty fast and in a hurry. And finally, time's a-wasting. The clock is ticking. No, this is not a basketball game. However, the stakes are just as important. When you're late for the date, it indicates that you think that your time is more valuable. Make sure that you leave a couple minutes early and show up on time. All right, lovers and friends, that's my dating advice for the week. Remember, y'all, don't fake it.